It's the Freethinker Club edition of Radio Freethinker. This week, Patush Dhawan and Darren Bell from the UBC Freethinkers Club. Let's begin episode 226.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Across the sea of space, the stars are alert. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, I'm Don, your philosopher of political science. Joining me today in the Radio Freethinker virtual studio is Patush Dhawan and Darren Bell from the UBC Freethinkers Club. Welcome.
Hi.
Hey.
Maybe you should get people know whose voice is whose. So, Patush.
Hi, I'm Patush. I'm president of the UBC Freethinkers.
And I am Darren. I am the vice president of the UBC Freethinkers.
So let me start off this week with a rant about Pope Francis. This is a pope that really confuses me. As a follow-up act to the former Nazi Pope Benedict, who at some times seemed to do some sideline work as Darth Vader's boss, anyone would sort of seem an improvement. That said, some of his recent comments by the Pope have led me start to think that maybe, well, he's a closet atheist, or worse, a communist. When the Pope took office, people were expecting a sort of humble papacy, no more Prada shoes of his predecessor. He is famous as a cardinal for living in a shared apartment, taking the bus to work, and just being, quote, a man of the common people. It seemed his abnormal behavior has fallen into the papacy. He's renounced, or at least redefined, papal infallibility as being consensus or communal infallibility. That, as he put it, quote, all the faith, considered as a whole, are infallible in matters of belief. He avoided the accusation of being a popularist by adding that the groupthink is influenced by the Holy Spirit, making it God's will or something. So essentially, he starts saying that, you know, it's the whole church that's infallible, not the Pope or the priestly class, which is a huge shift from what we traditionally think of papal infallibility. Well, recently he stunned the world when he said, well, commenting on Jesus, he said that the church says, quote, if he's not one of us, he cannot do good. If he is not of our party, he cannot do good. He then commented that the church was, well, a little intolerant, and then capped it with, the Lord has redeemed us all of us, with the blood of Christ, all of us, not just the Catholics, everyone, even the atheists, everyone, exclamation point. That's his exclamation point, not mine. Then he followed up with saying, if a homosexual person is of goodwill and is in search of God, I am no one to judge. Although, to be fair, I thought the Pope was the one who did a lot of the judging, but, and just a few days ago, he said, the church's pastoral ministry cannot be obsessed with a disjointed multitude of doctrines to be imposed insistently. The church cannot insist only on issues related to abortion, gay marriage, and the use of contraception. So, I was beginning to think that maybe the Pope was a closeted atheist. His attitudes are definitely unusual for the head of the Catholic Church. He has said many times that he is, quote, I am a sinner. This is the most accurate definition. It is not a figure of speech, a literary genre. I am a sinner. What if his sin is apostasy? Well, the Pope let me down Saturday when he came out and he said, quote, every child that isn't born but is unjustly condemned to abortion has the face of Jesus, has the face of the Lord. And he sees abortion as a symptom of, quote, our throwaway society. So it seemed like, okay, maybe he's not that much of an atheist after all. But then I was thinking that he also said, money sickens our world, poisons our thought. It leads us down the path of jealousy and conflict. It drives to idle words and pointless discussions. We can never serve God and money at the same time. So maybe not an atheist, but a communist. Well, okay, a lefty socialist at least. So I'm expecting anytime soon that the Vatican Bank and the Catholic Church in general will be writing everyone who's poor a nice big check. Any thoughts, guys?
Well, they can afford to.
They'd certainly be more Christ-like if they did that. It's true.
I've been wondering about this guy ever since that story came out of him washing the feet of those offenders in Italy. It just struck me as such a non-Pope thing to do, even if it was a Catholic thing to do.
Yeah, you usually don't see him getting down and dirty.
No, and actually, one of the things that church apologists, especially Catholic apologists, have sort of implied, but not always quite said it this way, is that, you know, if you follow the teachings of Jesus, you know, he was a pauper, he believed in poor people, he was very tolerant and all that. But if you follow those teachings of Peter, Peter was pretty much of the, you know, hard-ass nutjob kind of guy. Anyhow, we're going to go for a little break, and then we'll return after this.
Subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
We're back. So, guys, I got you in here to talk about the UBC Freethinkers Club. So let's first start off. What is the UBC Freethinkers Club, and what's its mandate?
Well, we don't have an official mission statement, really, but the club is there to, quote, promote a secular, humanistic, and rationalistic approach to life for those adhering to a naturalistic outlook, so like atheists, agnostics, humanist skeptics, as well as provide an education in science and critical thinking, unquote. I mean, it was basically founded, it's a pretty new club. It was founded in 2008, I think, by grad students who were looking for kind of an alternative community on campus, but it's grown to include many people who self-identify as free thinkers.
Do you know what the population of your club was last year, roughly?
Yeah, I think we had probably 70 paying members or so was the quote that I got from one of the former execs. But, I mean, there are many more people involved and who come out regularly to the events. I mean, it's not always the same people, but we get a good showing of about 20 to 30 people.
Now, I noted on your advertisement at Club Day that you had some definitions and terms. One of the terms is muggles. Do you guys think there's really magic in the world? Okay, I'm just kidding on that one. But really, what do you mean by some of the terms? Like, for example, you have atheist, agnostic, and both of these seem to sort of speak to the same question. So what do you mean by these terms?
Well, I would say they do sort of speak to the same question. I think that a lot of the times why there's separate categories is that colloquially, atheism seems to mean what is known as more specifically a strong atheism, or rather the claim that there is no God, like for sure.
Yeah.
And so people who see atheism as that, they don't want to label themselves anything close to what that name would imply. So they choose the name agnostic because it seems sort of less exact. Agnosticism is saying a statement about what you can know, it's saying, as opposed to being a Gnostic, someone who would have 100% knowledge, like as in the Gnostic traditions that, you know, where the whole thing came from, they claimed that they had knowledge about the spiritual realm and all of that. And instead of being like that, you say you're an agnostic. You can't have 100% absolute knowledge, or you're pretty sure that you can't have complete knowledge, to be even more careful. So basically, they choose that because it sort of seems safer. So they might actually hold the same position as and the general atheist who says they're an atheist because they live like there's no God, or they think it's very improbable that there is a God. But I would actually call myself an agnostic atheist. I'd say that I'm an atheist because I seem, not that I think that there is no God for sure, but rather that I think that gods are about as likely as any other mythological creature, unicorns, leprechauns, everything else. And I'd say I'm an agnostic because I'm very careful about saying there is not something or having absolute claims to knowledge. So that's why I like both of those terms.
So I kind of have two follow-ups in the same bit general area. So I guess, first of all, the simplest one is in the area of agnostic. I mean, I agree to some degree that you can't rule out any conceivable type God, but some of them are self-contradictory. I mean, most famously, obviously, is, you know, the Judeo-Christian God, whose definition becomes self-contradictory. contradictory, i.e. the whole omnipotence, problem of evil sort of thing. So do you limit it, or do you think, when you say agnostic, I mean any conceivable god, or just conceivable as in what exists here?
I think what they basically mean is, I mean, if you're an agnostic, I don't think they're talking about particular gods, even though the one most familiar to most people is the Judeo-Christian one. I think they basically mean supernatural things in general. So maybe, you know, they have some sort of like a deistic view or something, but they don't know, so they call themselves agnostics. I also find that people generally don't think about these questions a lot, so if someone's calling them an agnostic, it's also partly you don't want to be associated with people who say they're atheists, or you just don't care enough to go further.
As you just said yourself just a second ago, that to a certain degree, to believe in a god, and god defined in, I think, almost any way, relies on the idea of the supernatural, and to rely on the supernatural repudiates the natural. So, I mean, like could you not just say that, well, anything that might look like a god in the real world isn't really a god. We may call him a god, like people called Stalin a god, but nothing can be supernatural by definition.
Well, I would agree with you that nothing, but I don't think that anything can be supernatural by definition. I feel like supernatural as an idea itself is sort of what is not natural, and what is not natural seems to me to be things that don't exist. You know, like natural things are reality, you know, matter and energy, things that exist. And to say that something is supernatural is sort of what's not natural, sort of just nothing at all. But you can go into the realm of, well, it's really just imagination and all of that. But I disagree that supernatural things repudiate natural things. It's more that they add on to natural things. So they supernatural things don't say that there aren't natural phenomena, the people who believe in that. They just think there's natural phenomena plus all the other stuff, which I would say is just them projecting their own imagination onto the world.
It's kind of an intellectual cop-out.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, I almost thought that you had it there, because when you said you're an agnostic atheist, it's like, you know, I can't say whether there's something out there that appears to be a god, because I can't know that, but I'm an atheist because I believe that anything in the universe is natural, therefore a supernatural god can't exist.
Well, yeah, that's essentially the way that I put it. I just wouldn't be as strong as that, because I want to always be careful about knowledge claims, but I essentially am as strong as that when it comes down to it.
It's funny, even I refer to myself as an agnostic atheist, but I mean, when people ask, it's just atheist. And I mean, you guys are familiar with the Dawkins scale, right? Of 1 to 7. Yeah. I mean, I think when you ask most atheists, they'd say they were 6 or 7 on that, or 6, 2, 7.
Actually, I always refer to myself as an evangelical fundamentalist atheist. I'm out there to convert the believer and such. Okay, so let's bring this back to Earth a little bit more. I don't know if you've been following the news lately or listening to our last show, but the PQ in Quebec are attempting to pass a charter of values. They called it the secular charter during the election, an emphasis on the word secular. The ostensive reasoning for the bill is to treat religion like we do politics with regards to public service. We would think that it's inappropriate if our tax adjuster was sporting an NDP pin, so in the same way, they state that it's a secular state, so people should not be able to wear any overt religious symbols. So first off, as far as I've mentioned things, what do you think? And personally, you don't have to speak for the club on this.
I feel as though they need to look at the Canadian Charter of Rights again. I mean, in some ways, although I'm not familiar with the extent of the new laws, the PQ's charter seems a bit harsh and kind of racist. Like, I have no problem with public servants wearing religious symbols. I'm aware that most people consider it highly offensive, but what the PQ is doing, but that doesn't make it wrong. What makes it hard to stomach is the discrimination aspect coupled with the whole kind of like assimilation into Quebec culture thing.
Quebec is quite a unique experience because of its sort of threatened status as a French culture in an English continent. It even gets murkier when you start to think that, you know, not all religions are sort of equal when it comes to showiness of their symbols. So you have, like, the Sikhs who must wear the kapan and a turban. Devout Muslims might have to wear a hijab or a burqa. Jews wear their kippa or skull caps. Christians, on the other hand, are not compelled to wear their cross. And it gets even worse for the PQ when you learn that the cross in the National Assembly and a few others are exempt because they are not religious symbols, but historical/cultural. Worse again, prayer before municipal meetings is also exempt. Tax exempt exempt status for, quote, houses of worship will continue. And, of course, the biggest elephant in the room is the public funding of Catholic and religious schools will continue. Thoughts on these topics?
Oh, like, why are we surprised, though? I mean, just look at all the European nations with a population that's largely kind of passive towards religion. This is something we should be used to living in a predominantly Christian country. You'd expect that legal arm to be dipped in Christian sympathy before reaching into the public realm. I mean, I guess if they really want to make their point, then treat all religions the same. But in that case, like, law oversteps. Secularism is ideally inclusive of all belief systems, no matter how irrational. That's democracy.
Darren?
I think it's a tough issue about, you know, public officials wearing religious symbols. Religion is so bound to culture and personal identity that you can't always take those symbols away. I mean, you know, there's a problem with, I think it's Sikhs, or who is it that wears that little dagger?
You
know, people have had problems, with that all over the place, you know, and going on planes and everything. But I'm not completely against them wearing religious symbols, as long as it's, like, obviously important to their culture. So something like, the turban or the headscarves that Muslim women wear. So things like that, I think, are mostly harmless. But, if someone's wearing a shirt that says, like, all infidels will burn or something like that, you know, that's going too far, you know. So I think that it should be, like, a line here. But I also think that if it's personal prayer, it's okay. But if the organization is mandating that prayer, that also steps the line. So, you know, these are hard issues.
So what about, and then this is going to be kind of two parts, but in the same basic area. So the idea of having the cross in National Assembly, right, which doesn't seem to be a personal rights issue, where the other ones sort of are. Yes. And I know, where is your group when it comes to the idea of, well, activism in a small sense of the word, to push back on some of these things? So let's say that Vancouver City Council was going to enact a bylaw that mandated prayer before every council meeting. Would you guys say anything about that?
I think personally I would. That would be oppressive. That would be against our secular values. I definitely think that also we'd get a lot of support from religious groups as well. There's a lot of religious groups that recognize the value of secularism in how it actually helps religions. So, yeah, I think that our group would stand against that.
Yes, I've interviewed the executive director of BC's Humanist Society, and there does tend to be a lot of crossover between, I guess, what you would call very liberal religious groups and liberal atheist agnostic groups. Okay, so let's get back to the club. Another term that you define on your advertisement is skepticism. So what does that mean?
I mean, simply put, I think it's just the default position of doubt where you approach things critically. It's a way of straying away from dogma, using logic, reason, like making conclusions based on evidence. I mean, that's the most simple definition I have in my mind.
So let's put this to a test. The other day I was looking up and I saw St. John's wort, an herbal remedy, is supposed to be able to cure ailments of the liver. So how would a skeptic, in your view, approach this claim?
Well, first you have to look at whether it's based off of scientific trials, etc. Like, I mean, the first place would be the internet to go to, but also check out just the documents behind it. And, I mean, go to your doctor, ask him if it looks like it would actually work.
Yeah, I would say when you hear something like that, such a bold statement, X cures Y, without very much more detail, Not saying something like amazing new chemical found in X goes substantially towards the curing of Y, you know, something more careful like that. Alarm bells go up. That's what skepticism is. This is a bold claim. You've never heard anything about this before. Usually when you hear things like this, they turn out to be false, or at least not as much as they seem. So, yeah, then I would look up on the internet and try to find more information. And I wouldn't condemn it right away as false, for sure, but I also would, the alarm bells would go up. And I think that approach is what skepticism is.
So with regards to your club, then, do you guys offer any instruction with regards to how to become a better skeptic?
There have been events in the past. I mean, I'm thinking back to a couple of years ago, there was a kind of a forum on alternative medicine where it was an off-campus group that was holding it, but we let our members know, and a lot of people came out and asked really good questions. And it was basically getting people to think about alternative medicine in a new way, and that's like really taking a critical look at it. And that was just one of the things. I mean, there are a bunch of educational events that kind of promote this, let's call it skepticism of these grand claims.
Interesting. Okay, so let's shift gears again a little bit. And again, more terms. You didn't think this would be a school lesson, did you? But, it's a test. So what about humanism? I can see that skepticism, at least in my view, leads naturally into atheism. There's sort of a natural linkage there. But what about humanism? What's that got to do with your club?
I'm not as familiar with humanism as some of the other philosophies, but the humanists I know basically want to change the way people think to consider the human problem before all others. So before what your religious doctrines tell you or what your other moral authorities tell you, you consider the human question first. Basically, a rational method of approaching ethics. I mean, I know we have a few members who identify as humanists, but beyond that self-identification, I don't really know much about the difference in their philosophies or mine. I think more than anything, humanism is another search for that social community that skeptics or freethinkers tend to lack.
Yeah, I think for me, humanism is sort of identified with people who are atheist or agnostic, who are rationalists, who are empiricists, maybe naturalists, wanting to chart out that landscape of human values, of morality, in a way that is non-dogmatic, in a way that is not colored by or dictated by established traditions. And they would be inspired by works of literature and philosophies of the world, and they would value human dignity, they would value freedom, and these sorts of things. And I think that that fits perfectly into our group, because our group is all about that. It's all about all of those values that I just mentioned, and especially having a place to express yourself that is not bound by dogmas, not bound by traditions. That's what free thought is all about to me.
I think one of the things that I was just thinking about was the fact that even if you look online at discussions on humanism, like some humanists consider it almost as pseudo-religion and others are more against that. So it's funny seeing that dynamic.
It's actually also kind of interesting, again, because my contact with humanists, which I guess would include myself, I guess I think I'm a humanist, is it's a very big melting pot between atheists and theists, you know, because again, the idea of trying to better humanity, to care about fellow humans and that sort of thing, which is an important part about the whole, you know, social bonding, is appealable to both people with and without faith. And that's where you get a lot of interesting combinations in humanist world. So lastly, and this is the money shot of the terms, free thinker. We did an interview with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and we asked him if he thought he was a free thinker, and he was a little coy with his answer.
Dr. Tyson, thanks for joining us on Radio Free Thinker.
Thank you. Does that mean I'm a free thinker? Is that what that implies?
That's what we hope. You are a free thinker.
I think how I want. Is that counts as a free thinker?
That sounds perfect.
No, I think in whatever direction the evidence takes me.
Ah, that's even better.
That's even better, yeah.
The idea of, quote, free thinker has been used by those who think that 9/11 was an inside job, Big Pharma wants to make us sick, the Illuminati control the world. Well, you kind of get the idea. Free Thought Radio is a libertarian talk show. So what does free thinker mean to you, and why are you so attracted to it?
Well, for me, I mean, I'm one of those people who believes that even religious people can call themselves free thinkers. It's an odd term, but in its most basic definition, I take it to describe someone who's willing to question their beliefs, habits, get into discussions with others where they're seriously reconsidering their most fundamental ways of knowing or being. It is ambiguous. I suppose one of the reasons the club's founders might have chosen Freethinker is because it has less of a stigma attached to it, and I personally know of many religious people who are completely comfortable with calling themselves Freethinkers, so that inclusivity of the term might have been appealing. And that's kind of why I like it too. We don't want a club with one-sided discussions where everyone agrees on most or all of the, at least the religious discourse brought in front of us. We want those opposing voices as well.
Meetings could be so much quicker, though, if everyone just agrees. It's like...
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what Freethinker, what that means to me is a reaction to the constraints of dogmatism, to the constraints of adhering to tradition conservatively. And, you know, you can be, that is a pretty open label, and we like that so that we're inclusive as a group to people of all sorts of worldviews, also inclusive of people who believe in religion, as long as they have that sort of free approach to knowledge. And, you know, there's a quote that I like by John Stuart Mill that's about this. He says, human nature is not a machine to be built after a model and set to do exactly the work prescribed for it, but a tree which requires to grow and develop itself on all sides according to the tendency of the inward forces which make it a living thing. So that's what free thought is to me. It's not being bound into a model, but recognizing your limitations and trying to strive for the truth.
Really? Okay, so I noticed that your table was in the religious section. Considering that part of your mission is sort of non-religion, that seems kind of weird. Do you guys like being in the religious section?
I love being in the religion section, personally. We just got thrown in there, and our booth has always been in that section in the past. But I love it. I love being put up against people who have other worldviews as I do, and grappling with them about the big questions and considering that thing, as long as they do it in a respectful manner, of course. And I love being surrounded by people who have different opinions than me, because then they start to challenge your belief. And I know that most of what I believe to be true, or a lot of what I believe to be true, has to be wrong. There's no way that I've gotten everything right so far, and there's many things I have no idea about at all. So I'd rather not be too stuck fast in what my beliefs are. I'd rather have people to challenge them. And so that's why I love talking to religious people.
I think Pudush had mentioned that in this same area was the accountancy group, meditation, and Mahjong. And I think I understand why those were all there, if you think about it. Because, I mean, let's face it, religion doesn't really add up. So maybe the accountancy is sort of saying, hey, guys. And, of course, you know, you need a lot of strategic thinking to try and defend something that isn't really true. So the Mahjong people have a natural tie-in. And, of course, after all that labor, you need to meditate just to relax from the whole effort.
I mean, part of the mandate is also we're trying to provide an alternative to those religious groups. So I think just being in that section, we're giving people the option.
Yeah, that's true.
So you claim to be open to all faiths, but that seems to be a bit inconsistent with skepticism/non-theism aspects of the club. So I guess I have sort of two questions. You claim to be open, but really, someone who has sort of supernatural beliefs in a deity or deities, well, that seems sort of anathema to your implied mission. So how do you square the circle?
Squaring the circle. It's more about getting some interesting conversations going. I mean, like I said before, if we were just a bunch of atheists sitting around the table planning events and discussing issues without any alternative perspective, I feel as though we'd be missing out on some valuable dialogue. Of course, we want to advocate a worldview that excludes supernatural elements, but without involving religious or spiritual students, we're not really getting anywhere. The club also provides, I mean, educational events, things like that. Whether you're religious or not, you might disagree on, you know, euthanasia, bioethics reform, etc. So it's better to have as many sides as possible in those debates.
So essentially, you think of it as sort of like the soup kitchen of a church. You get the people in because you want to have stimulating conversations. And once they're there, hey, have you thought about atheism lately? Or something like that.
I wouldn't put it that way. But
okay, I'm being a bit disingenuous. My apologies.
I mean, most people who show up would consider themselves in the atheist, agnostic, skeptic bowl, but it's always nice to have an alternative view.
Okay, so let's go with that then. But how do you reach someone who, you know, from the standpoint is somewhat irrational in their primary beliefs? And I mean, don't get me wrong, no one has to be sort of a perfect skeptic. My views on panspermia, cut off if you don't know what it means, may not be completely backed up with evidence. That said, it doesn't really play a major role in my life. But some things, like religious beliefs, does play a major role. So you said you like to bring these people in and you want to have this great dialogue. Well, does this require some kind of special handling on your part?
I'm not really sure. The degrees to which religion influences someone are always up in the air. I'm pretty sure someone who's like dead set on their path to heaven won't be showing up at any of our events. But from my standpoint, if we're a welcoming and inclusive group that engages in those big questions, then at the very least, we're erasing the erosive notion that atheists are all terrible people and should be avoided. That's not exactly a popular view around UBC or Vancouver in general, but some people still hold on to those old ideas.
I've talked to a lot of religious people about topics like this, not directly through the Freethinkers Club, but if it happens during there, I think my approach would be the same. Personally, I like to start with something like getting down our justifications for beliefs. I like to start with evidentialism, which is my personally what I think one of the best epistemological approaches to belief, talking about what is requisite for belief and talking about evidence and all of that. And if you start from that kind of very simple basis, you know, almost a Cartesian kind of building up, you know, like let's assume first of all nothing's true, that you can have some really interesting conversations with religious people, getting them to challenge their beliefs in a very polite and gentle way.
Cool. So now I understand that you inherited your current advert for the club, so I'm not going to put you too much on the spot here, but on it shows some famous skeptics. You have Charles Darwin, Carl Sagan, and because I'm a man, I don't know who the woman was on it, but I'm sure she's really important.
Neither do I, actually.
So we recently had some members of the Carl Sagan Association for the Communication of Science on the show. So first, do you know any of these people? And if you do, why do you think they're important symbols to have on your advert?
I suspect Darwin's up there because of evolution. I mean, he's such a polarizing historical figure in religious circles, but kind of a Flagstaff head for atheists. Sagan, I can understand too. He's kind of an obvious choice. We all know that he was a great science popularizer and voice espousing skepticism. But I wouldn't call them symbols of the club. They're just examples of what a skeptic, scientist, freethinker looks like.
If you were to choose, would you add or remove any of them? I mean, space is limited and times are changing.
I'd probably add some contemporary figures, maybe some non-scientists and perhaps some more women, just because the whole issue of women in the skeptic movement, just to get a little more diverse. Examples aren't really jumping to mind. Maybe we should put Neil Tyson on for next year with Cosmos coming out. On the literary side, I jump to authors like Douglas Adams, Ian McEwan, Philip Pullman. Yeah.
I would put Jacob Bronowski up. That's who I would put. I really enjoy his series, The Ascent of Man. It's just very inspiring. It's another series like Cosmos by Carl Sagan.
Okay, so again, I'm drawing on your advertisement again. You have some classic images on there. You have Bigfoot, the Spaghetti Monster, even reflexology, you know, or something to do with feet anyway. But there's also sexuality and politics. Now, I know, again, you guys didn't create this, but, well, do you think there are limits to free thought?
Do you mean that the club is biting off more than it can chew, or that those topics really shouldn't be our focus?
Well, let's say it shouldn't be your focus. We'll start with that one.
I think skepticism can be applied across a huge range of topics. I mean, we try to cater to whatever the members want, so people tell us what they're interested in hearing more about or having a discussion about, and that's kind of where we go. And I guess those things have been included. I know that some of them have been, especially on the health side, they've been included often in our discussions.
So related to that, there is a major kerfuffle in the skeptic community, which you guys may not know about what is or is not appropriate for skepticism. This kind of relates to what your answer was. The first point was, should skepticism be limited to hard science, you know, areas where there is black and white answers? Or should we be able to use the skeptical toolkit for non-science issues like inequality, economics, etc.? Where things really turned ugly was, with this current kerfuffle, was when feminism collided with sort of classic skepticism, the idea that skepticism has moved forward into social issues. I'm assuming you are blissfully aware of this issue, but my question to you both again, and make it personal, maybe not representative of clubs, but do you think skepticism has a place in social issues, beyond ethics, even ethics?
Yeah, I think it absolutely. I think skepticism has a place everywhere. I think because ultimately, what you're doing if you're arguing anything is you're arguing for the truth. You're trying to get closer to the truth. You're trying to get people to believe what you're talking about. And if someone is making a claim anywhere, they're making a claim about what is true to some extent. So skepticism comes in here in evaluating those truth claims. In its toolkit, the toolkit of skepticism can be applied to a whole variety of things. Are they likely to be true? So for social issues, is it really true that we'd be, I don't know, that like a certain economic group is hurting the world maybe, or all these things? Is it really true that feminism, you can be skeptical about is it really true that feminism and skepticism clash? I am skeptical of that claim. I think that it's not true. I think it's maybe some versions of feminism clash with some perceived versions of skepticism. Having the skeptical toolkit is important in approaching these claims.
I mean, I think by ignoring those issues and only focusing on religion, we'd be shortchanging a large part of this. Let's call it like skeptic community. You have plenty of people who are marginalized because of their views on social or sexual issues, and that brings them to advocacy on behalf of critical thought in the first place.
Yeah, no, one of the mandates of this particular show is to use the skeptical toolkit and apply it to non-traditional areas. Just last show we did, is economics a science or not, right? And that was quite interesting. There is the reverse question, though. Have you guys heard of Sam Harris's The Moral Landscape?
Yes.
Heard of it, not read it.
So in that book, he makes the claim that through science, eventually, we'd be able to determine what is the correct ethical choice about most things. Maybe not everything, but most things, or at least some things. And he got a lot of blowback about that. And this is sort of the opposite of skepticism applied to sort of fuzzy areas. This is the idea that, do you think science will be able to solve all our problems? In three words or less.
Yes, maybe no.
I would say, rather than science being able to solve all our problems, that a certain rational and skeptical approach to truth, which scientists certainly have, but not only scientists, also historians and people in the social sciences as well, that is the way to get to truth. That's how you get there, evidentially, and also with this skeptical toolkit. But on the moral question, I'd say that would be fantastic. Definitely, we should pursue a science of morality. But until I see it start working, and until I see the actual research on it, I'm going to remain skeptical.
I wonder how much he focused on kind of like a case by case thing.
Well, a lot of his idea is not so much that you can find out what is the right or the wrong thing. It's the idea that some things are more right and more wrong. So the idea that jaywalking may be a moral wrong, but it's not on the same level as something like genital mutilation. And you can kind of empirically measure the harm done in the two things so that, maybe, you're going to ride your bike or you're going to take a car or what have you. Those may be possible options, but you could say these other options are much worse. That's sort of where he was going with it. And it was more general. It's a good book to read, even though Sam Harris is a racist and a bit of a gun nut. But I like some of his ideas, and we shouldn't be dogmatic about people any more than we should be about ideas. So
it's certainly an area that I think will be pursued, if not by Sam Harris, many people.
Well, I think that what Sam Harris is doing is essentially utilitarianism or consequentialism, isn't it? So, I mean, I don't know a super huge amount about those fields of thought because I'm not in philosophy, but I've read John Stuart Mill's book, Utilitarianism, and it seems to me a very promising way to look at morality, sort of toting up, so you sort of start with what is good is the best possible world, or the best possible condition for all conscious creatures. And if you say that is good, then everything that gets us closer to that is also going to be a moral action. So actions that you close to that. And I think personally that's a pretty good starting point for thinking about moral issues.
And it's obvious by reducing it into a numbers game, making it a science, people are going to have problems with it.
Okay, so before we make this personal, what events, projects, what have you, is the club working to in the future?
We have our first games night on Monday. We started with our socials successfully, and we'll continue them regularly throughout the year. They happen about 2 to 3 times a month. There's also a rumor going around about a movie night in the middle of October. Other than that, since club's days just ended, we'll be focusing on getting some speakers to come in, depending on what our members are interested in seeing.
Okay, now let's get personal. I understand that you, Darren, are a naturalist. No, not as in nudity. I mean, are you nudist? Don't answer that. Really makes no difference to the show. Nothing to see here. Move along. Okay, maybe I should say that you believe in spirituality. So as an atheist, you already said you're an atheist, so what does that mean?
Well, I take spirituality in obviously a more metaphorical sense. I go back to the root of that word. I think it was spiritus. It's a or something like that. It's a Latin word. It meant wind, or it meant essence. And when you're getting into spirituality, you're really getting in what is the essence of being human. So what does it like mean to be human, and how can you develop that realm, the realm of meaning and your reaction to that, the more emotional side of things. And so I say that I'm an atheist. I say that I'm a naturalist. So I believe, you know, the only thing that exists is what exists, matter and energy and space-time. And that mind is all in that. And as a naturalist, I still think it's important to live a meaningful life, to live and to look at, you know, religions and philosophies and see how they approached this, sort of cut through, okay, maybe they were wrong about what they said cosmologically about the world, there's probably no gods, but to get over that and to start thinking, how did they approach living? What were the practices that they used to gain a deeper understanding of what it means to be human? How did they approach the mysterious, the ineffable, moments of doubt? To look at that and to try to bring that all together and to make sense of being human. So that's what that means to me.
So you probably heard then about, you know, God of the brain, and that there's somewhat of a genetic disposition for us to believe in something supernatural, something perhaps with our tendency to find patterns and everything. So do you think it's this sort of biological urge, or do you think it's more epiphenomenal, something about our humanity? I'll put it this way before you continue.
Okay.
Do you think bonobos have a sense of awe at the universe?
I think that it is essentially on a scale. I don't think that a lot of people say, you know, there's something special about being human, or, you know, that, like, I'm in linguistics and they're always talking about human language is totally special. Like, it's completely different than other language. And then they find something that sort of that challenges their definition of human language as only human, and, you know, they have to make up more things. So in the same way, I think that probably other animals do have that kind of sense of connection and sense of awe and bliss and things. But because our brains are more, you might want to say, developed, capable of maybe more information processing, more computing power in these areas, that we have a sort of a ramped up scale of that. And so that's how I would answer that. I would say that, yeah, it's obviously biological what's going on in our connection to greater things. And I would say that we're not unique, and it's completely possible for there to be organisms on different planets that are better at doing what we do than we do, and can have a even more profound sense of their connection to the world and emotions, or a completely different kind of connection that we can't even think of.
Very interesting. So I understand that you like to study religion. You already mentioned that, you know, religion, philosophy sort of thing. But as a fellow atheist, shouldn't you shun all religious texts?
I don't think so, because we have always had the same brain. We haven't always. We've had the same brain we have now for maybe 10,000 years. And maybe we didn't know as much about the world empirically as we do now, but we've been stuck with the same, you know, how do I deal with being a human? How do I deal with my emotions? How do I deal with living in a community? How do I deal with not knowing everything about the universe? All these things for so long. So I think that there definitely are wisdoms in other perspectives, even if they're a little bit archaic and wrong about many things. And so, like, for instance, if you look at something as what is now as despicable to me as the crucifixion of Jesus in Christianity, you can look at that see how terrible it is, how immoral that kind of idea is, how it's obviously wrong in the first place that it ever happened. But if you sort of look at it metaphorically, if you look at the whole religion thing as a metaphor, you see really what that is God becomes this projection of the highest moral values of a culture, you know, absolute goodness, absolute justice, absolute mercy. And so that culture projects their own human values, the best values they can think of, onto the physical world and sort of confuses it. And then you have this being who loves us, who creates us. God creates us to be this certain way, to have these values. And that's kind of like culture showing us what we should be. It's showing us, pay attention to these values. These values are important. And all the decisions in your life they have cosmic importance. So it's sort of a metaphor, and obviously they think it's true, and that's where it's wrong. But if you think of it like this, it's a metaphor for how to relate yourself in the world, how to live your life. And the crucifixion is saying to me, we do things that are wrong, and these consequences, these things we do have wrong, have real consequences in the world. Someone's got to pay for these things. They really do bad things, and the crucifixion is sort of the consequence in our face. Look, what's the consequence of your actions? Obviously, it's sort of bloody and disgusting and a little bit crude, but if we look at religions from this perspective, we can sort of see what's important about being human and how to relate ourselves to the universe and how to live with moral people.
Atush, do you have any thoughts on this? If the idea, maybe I think this is what Darren is encapsulating, if we saw religion as just a philosophy, then the texts have value as in any other philosophical or literary text. You study literature, right?
Yeah, and in fact, a lot of our studies, I've taken a couple courses just on stories from the Bible. I've had these discussions with other people as well. I mean, you don't have to take it literally. If you take it as metaphor, if you take it as philosophy, still there are many problems with it. But perhaps, I mean, I'm not really getting the whole coming at it from a new perspective thing, but I do realize that these texts, especially the older you get, I mean, they're filled with wisdom, and that's in the first place why a lot of people, that's where they point to when they say, oh, I believe this because of all this wisdom. They never talk about the supernatural aspect, so I can understand looking at it from that perspective.
So, Patricia, I understand that you like astronomy. What do you think of the idea that the first man-made object has left our solar system, that humanity is truly now an interstellar species?
Okay, first of all, I mean, I've been waiting for this announcement for so long, only to be reminded by Phil Plait last week that Voyager still hasn't left the solar system. What a bummer. But over the past couple of years, they kept saying, you know, Voyager's gone interstellar, only to retract their statements. But yeah, we've sent a robot to interstellar space. That's awesome. I'm still wondering whether it counts, though, seeing as we have no control over its trajectory. But the fact that we're getting info from this thing that's past the heliopause is maddeningly cool.
I think, actually, one of the coolest things is the gold records that are on there. That, you know, even though we don't control it, there is humanity put on that spaceship.
Okay, so maybe it does count. Recordings of people, animals, all that has reached interstellar space. Some jazzy music records.
Yeah, it's really inspiring to me to think, what if, it's just like the tiniest speck of dust in infinity, basically. So the chances of, if there are aliens out there, ever finding it are extremely slim, just unimaginably slim. But just to have that hope, maybe, what would they think if they found this object? What would they think about us? That's just such an amazing thing to think about.
I often think about the inverse of, like, what if a hunk of metal came into our solar system with a bunch of random stuff in it, and we were all confused for a while. But I suppose, I mean, that with this story going on the major newspapers, online, etc., like, people reading it, it gives you some kind of perspective that it took this machine 36 years to get to the edge, and it still has many thousands of years before it actually leaves our solar system. So,
well, that was actually one of the things I found studying that I never thought about, but the Oort cloud apparently is not considered to be within our heliosphere.
Because other stars can influence those objects.
Exactly, and that just strikes me as, because it's part of it orbits our sun. I mean, how could it not be part of our solar system? But what do I know? One of the things that's interesting is this, I guess, race for contact, because obviously speed won't be in there, between the gold plate that has humanity on it, on the Voyagers, and our first sort of quote, possible interstellar broadcast, which was the 1936 Berlin Games with Adolf Hitler and such. I wonder what kind of confusion that's going to show for our aliens.
Is that strong enough to actually get far? I'm not really sure, but if it is, then that's kind of disappointing. that would be the first thing that would show up on their radar.
It's one of those interesting yes-no situations that if you had a big enough antenna and sufficiently advanced technology, then yes, you should. I don't think we could pick it up because we don't have sufficient...
yeah,
which I guess means maybe we're missing an aliens version of the rise of Hitler, but who knows? So on that note, what do you think? Do you think there's life in Europa, Enceladus, something like that?
I certainly think it's a huge... Like, I mean, I was hoping that by the time I was this age that exploration would have already started. Like, they'd already have sent, NASA would have already sent robots to Enceladus or Europa to check underneath the ice, see if there's anything there. I'm intrigued by the possibility, but I'm still doubting whether, you know, life can pop up twice in the same solar system. But if that is the case, I just imagine how... it would change how we look at the rest of the universe.
So we're at the end of the show now, and I'm going to give each of you guys, if you want, a minute or so to just sort of say, hey, audience, you should know about this. What sort of things do you think our audience should know about?
I think that people should look more into religious or spiritual naturalism, as it's called. It's not very popular. It's not very wildly known, but it's kind of like... a version of secular humanism in the sense that secular humanism is trying to chart out that map of what's important as a human who doesn't believe in the supernatural realm. And it's very inspiring, I think, to me to look at other religions and other ways of thought through a secular and naturalist lens, as well as to get inspired by the universe and to really dig into that. And it has also a very interesting outtake on morality as well, and what our responses should be to ecological threats and things like that. So I think it's a very exciting new approach to morality and spirituality.
Could you give our listeners maybe one resource, a book, a website, something you saw that you think good?
I would say that the website Spiritual Naturalist Society.
There'll be a link on our website.
Yeah, we can put a link up there. The Spiritual Naturalist Society is a really fantastic society that I'm a part of that is all about that. As well, the book Nature is Enough. Is a good one. I don't remember. Oh, Nature is Enough by Loyal Rue is very good. It's philosophy, religious philosophy, I suppose you can call it, but it's not really a religion. And it's about how, you know, we should relate to meaning in our lives from a religious naturalist perspective, and just what that means. What is meaning? Is there any such thing as human meaning or meaning, ultimate meaning in the world? Oh, yes, and another important book is The Sacred Depths of Nature by Ursula Goodenough. She is a biologist, and that book is jam-packed with biology. It's essentially each chapter is just educating you on the science of how things are the way that they are in the world, how biological systems are the way they are, and how the universe began. And then at the end of each chapter is a reflection to that. And it has some religious quotes, and she usually gives those religious quotes without much explanation, and you sort of have to see her purpose behind that and see how she's sort of knitting these things together, our sort of spiritual reaction to what science shows us is real about the world. So that's definitely a book I would suggest, The Sacred Depths of Nature by Ursula Goodenough.
Cool. Dish, anything from you?
Yeah, I've noticed in the past couple of years that I've been involved with this club, I've kind of gravitated more towards bigger philosophical questions, or I should say smaller philosophical questions, not so much on the whole religion side of focusing on debates and stuff around God, but other things such as the notions of free will. And I've found a lot of disagreement in the skeptical community just on these basic topics, you know, even something as simple as something like abortion issue is a huge deal for some people, especially when it comes to late term and what you consider a person, etc. So I've kind of gravitated away from the religious discourse and now more on thinking about these, I guess, more human issues and what they mean. So yeah, just like, I think this year we'll be focused more on the moral question of, you know, we'll be looking at things like free will, we'll be looking at morality of pornography, maybe bringing in feminist issues. So not just a Freethinkers Club focused on religion, but many other things.
How dare you try to expand people's minds?
I know.
So I'd like to thank both of you guys for coming on the show. I guess this is the end of the show, so eyes open, minds on.
Did you wish to make an apple pie from scratch? You must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant.
NASA Johnson Star. Johnson Star. Welcome to NASA's Johnson Space Center. We are coming in hot, so don't burn up as we enter. We do science every day that affects your daily life. Throw them up for manned space flight.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
CITR 1019, 4 o'clock Tuesday. That means it's time for Discorder Radio. Oh, yeah. Oh, we got a jam-packed show for you today. One of the things we're going to talk about is experimentation and distortion. Something you're hearing a lot of right now. Why? Because Polaris Prize was given out last night in Toronto, and there's been no tons of controversy. News 101 Morgan Yee is here. We're going to talk about that in a little bit, about the Polaris Prize. We're going to talk about the Pop Montreal Festival happening this weekend. Going to hear a bit of an interview with the Gay 90s.